This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. Now, you may or may not know the name Doug Allen. Doug's a highly regarded wildlife cameraman and photographer. His name appears in the credits of David Attenborough's Blue and Frozen Planet series. At the beginning of this year, Doug happened to be in Aberdeen, which is quite close to where I live, giving a talk in his career as part of Royal Scottish Geographical Society series of lectures. I went along to the lecture, which was fascinating, and I got hold of him at the end of the day and I said, look, can we meet up tomorrow? I'd just like a chance to chat with you in a bit more leisure. He very kindly agreed and we took a wander along the beach.
I come from Dunfermline in Fife. That's where I was born and bred, and I lived there till I went to university. Went to university in Stirling and then more or less started to travel when I graduated. Although my first job, interestingly, I worked with Bill Abernethy, Scotland's last full-time pearl fisherman. I was his diver, effectively, for a year just after I left university. And we had a great time, good fun. And then I headed off, really. Went to the Red Sea, Germany, Jersey, back to the Red Sea, Antarctic, and then chance meeting with David Attenborough in the Antarctic. That took me into wildlife filming. You know, it all sounds very glib and easy, but there was a few bits of good fortune, and you know, I took advantage of things that came my way, but I really just built one interest on top of the other. It started with diving. Diving took me to the biology. Biology took me to expeditions, then the Antarctic, and it was only in the Antarctic that I found photography. I did a lot of stills photography in the Antarctic. It was such a novel place to live, not just for the wildlife, but for the whole way that we lived. The first base was only 16 of us there for the winter, 16 men. So it was quite an interesting dynamic. And it suited me absolutely to the ground and the way that we lived and all the rest of it. Anyway, so I did a lot of stills photography of the animals and the lifestyle and things. And then I met David after I did 3 winters. And I met David at the end of the third winter, or halfway through the final summer. And I helped his film crew for a couple of days. I just watched this cameraman and I thought, you know, you're doing all the things that turn me on. And so I said, I remember David, I said to David, I said, I want to do that guy's job. I want to do Hugh's job. And he was really helpful, him and the producer and the cameraman. They all told me how the business worked and freelance and all the rest of it. But they also said, you know, what you know about the Antarctic, we don't know anybody else that knows that. Africa, fine, there's dozens of folk know about Africa. But wildlife in the Antarctic, it's kind of tricky in diving and all the cold stuff. You know, that's a good place to be if you want to set out, because you've got that wee niche that just belongs to you. So that's why I've done a disproportionate amount of cold stuff over the years. And, you know, it served me well. That was a long answer to a very short question.
Not at all. No, I'm delighted to get it. Curious about the diving aspect of it, in Antarctica particularly, because yeah. I mean, you know, most diving, you use a buddy principle. You never really dive alone.
Mm-hmm.
Add to that the fact that you are working under sheet ice a lot of the time in sub-zero conditions.
Well, in the Antarctic, my job was to help the scientists to get their work done. So we weren't diving on our own. You know, I was diving with a scientist, what have you. And yes, for about half of the year, we'd be diving under ice, either solid ice or, you know, grease ice, pancake ice, all the different kinds of ice. And it was pretty cold. I mean, in the winter, it went down to -1.8 degrees centigrade. And in the summer, it reached the balmy...
This is in the water.
In the water. The water is -1.8. The air temperature could go down to -30, 35. And then in the summer, the seawater would heat up to the balmy temperature of zero. And it was funny, you know, we dived in the lakes as well, Mark. We dived in the lakes, and the lakes, of course, are freshwater. So they only get down to zero before they freeze. And I used to quite look forward to the lake dives in winter because the water was warmer in the lakes than it was in the sea. But yeah, and we were also diving in wetsuits.
Why?
Well, you may well ask, but actually back in those days, dry suit technology wasn't anything like as advanced as it is now. Uh-huh. And a lot of the guys who were diving had actually learned to dive in order to do their science. So they weren't all that experienced. And it's much easier to teach someone to dive in a wetsuit than it is in a dry suit. Mm-hmm. And they weren't standard wetsuits. They were 10 millimetres thick, uh-huh, neoprene, and completely unlined. You know, they had no nylon lining on the inside. So by the time you got them on with the long johns and then the jacket over the top, no zips anywhere and no stitching, all the seams just butt glued and taped over. So they were almost dry suits in themselves, but wetsuit principle. And they kept you pretty warm for the diving that we wanted to do. We got changed in the warmth. We had the hole cut in the ice beforehand. We'd go out from the base, drive out straight into the hole. You could spend up to 45 minutes, an hour maybe at the sort of depths we were at, because we're only at 10 metres, 12 metres depth usually. So you could get a good hour's diving out of that before you got too cold. And then up and back into the base hot shower and that was it.
Define too cold.
Well, you could get hypothermic in the water, there's no doubt about that. But on the other hand, you don't get frostbite because you don't quite get to the frozen stage. But that was where you realise your limit. Some people somehow expect, even when you go diving today in cold water and with dry suits and things, when you get down to that temperature, there's still some folk that think somehow you're going to stay warm. Well, you stay warm a wee bit, but eventually you get cold and you just have to put up with it. And that's sort of what you do, you learn to put up with it. Some guys would get colder quicker than others, and that's where you learn your own limits. And maybe I was lucky, but you know, I could do an hour okay. If it was interesting work, it would be okay. And then you'd come out, and as long as you gave yourself, you know, 3 or 4 hours between the next dive, then you would be okay for 2 or 3 dives a day. Not for everybody, though.
No, you know? No, not for everybody. Where did you learn your field craft? Because I was watching your presentation last night, you know, and the films of you with dolphins and botos and whales and everything else, etc. Where do you pick up that knack?
I think you have to have an inbuilt knack for it. You know, I could tell if people have that knack by watching how they behave around dogs or how they behave around horses or how they behave around babies under the age of 2, where there's audible communication, but the baby doesn't understand what you're saying, but it does respond to the tone of voice that you're using. But it also responds to how you move around it and how you bend down and pick it up and how you might go up close to it, but not try to do anything. Just let the baby watch you for a wee while, that kind of thing, or the toddler, let's say. And so you have this kind of feeling for animals and a feeling for the environment. Because sometimes if you're working in the water, you know, it can be pretty hostile, lumpy seas, what have you. So you need to be really confident and laid back and all the rest of it. But I've found the secret too. No matter how much you want to get close to an animal or want to see it or want to be in its presence to film it, if you're too keen, it won't like it. You need to be kind of relaxed and not really thinking, well, if this animal just keeps on behaving, that'll be fine. But if it doesn't, well, we'll come back some other day. And you've got to help the animal to relax yourself. And I don't know where that comes from. But then the fieldcraft side of things, it's all about experience of, you know, becoming aware of the wind direction. If you're dealing with a polar bear, you know, try and come at it from downwind so it doesn't smell you. You know, sometimes when we're doing polar bears, for example, there'd be 2 of us on snow machines. So the best thing is to see your polar bear from a long way away. Decide, you know, what's it doing? Is it hunting? Is it sleeping? Is it suckling its young? Is it walking? All those sort of things determine how you might try to get close to it. And then when you do try to get close to it with 2 snow machines, try and get a line where one snow machine can go behind the other. So basically it looks like to the polar bear like there's just one thing coming, slowly getting a little bit bigger. Don't drive at high speed across its field of view, because they kind of, you know, that puts them off. So there's all these sort of things. And then there's, you know, there's a field craft of survival in the cold, knowing what clothes to wear, knowing your limits. And the same thing goes for any habitat, whether you're, you know, working in a rainforest or the wide open Arctic. You know, we have a saying that any fool can be uncomfortable. And so it's down to the right clothes, the right sort of protection for yourself, looking after yourself, recognising when things get too cold or there's too many bugs or something like that, and just having the patience to wait for a better day.
You can have the field craft. You know, you can have this understanding that essentially you have to let the animals come to you to a certain extent. How does that work when you've got a keen, enthusiastic young production team?
I see you've worked in the business before. Yeah, well, it's, you know, everybody has to learn, and they're all at different stages of, like you say, enthusiasm. I think it is easier if you're working with people where everyone in the team recognises their different strengths and doesn't try to impose their will upon the other person until they've fully listened or watched the other person and decided whether they've actually got anything sensible to add to the mix. But I like working with other people, and I think generally that if everyone's getting on well and adding little bits to what you might be doing, then that's when, you know, the end product is greater than the sum of the parts. You get everyone's experience in there. That's one of the big differences. When I started shooting on film, of course, you never saw anything. You would go away, be out there for 3 weeks, a month in the wilds, and you never saw a single frame of what you'd shot because it was all on the film and the film wasn't processed, etc. But now that we're shooting on tape and now, you know, on hard drives and things, everybody can look at it. So the minute everybody can look at it, everybody becomes a director and a cameraman. And it can be difficult when you're there with the camera actually rolling and there's a big monitor and you're looking at it and you get this nudge on your shoulder and they kind of whisper, get the close-ups, get the close-ups. You think, I know I'm going to get the close-ups in a minute, you just shut up, you know, that kind of thing. But that's rare. Usually everybody can laugh about it, eventually.
You obviously have an enormous respect for the wildlife that you film. Have you ever been at risk from it?
Yeah, I've, you know, working with polar bears and things and big whales demands their respect. There are times when you recognise a change in an animal's behaviour, which might begin to imply that it's got bored with you or tired and it's time to move on somewhere else. You know, a whale that's been quite happy for you to play around all day, it can flap its tail and it's gone, but it might begin to show it by turning tail towards you and swishing its tail from side to side through the water, and that's a kind of sign that, you know, I've had enough. Or it might be that a whale just gets a bit too familiar with you. You know, we had a calf in the water with us one day, and this thing would come right up to you, and then it would dive down just in front of you and then turn underwater and flick its tail over the top, kind of about to whap you on the head. And it did this closer and closer and closer, and eventually I thought, sooner or later he's going to get me.
So I'm going to take the hint.
So I bailed out, exactly. And then there was the famous, famous because I think I've told the story quite often about the walrus that grabbed me when I was in the water up in Canada. I just finished filming some birds diving underwater, and suddenly something grabbed me around the top of the thighs, and I looked down and a walrus had come up from the depths and wrapped its flippers round about me. Basically, it had thought I was a seal. Walruses usually feed on mussels and clams down in the seabed, but sometimes they'll change their diet and they feel like eating a seal. So they go looking for, quite often, sleeping seals, because sleeping seals, they just hang in the water like bottles, just with their noses sticking up. And when they see that little nose sticking up, the little head sticking up, the walrus will dive down and then it'll swim underneath the seal, look up, and you can see a lot of stuff silhouetted against the sky. And up it comes from the depths, grabs the seal and takes it down. And so that's what I think it did to me. As it was, it grabbed me. I was able to swing the camera around, hit it on the head, and luckily it let me go, which was good. And it was pretty lucky that it took me low on the body, because when I spoke to some of my Inuit friends afterwards who had seen walrus being taking seals, they said that in quite a few cases the walrus tries to take the seal high on the body to pin the seal's flippers to its side so it can't swim away, and in that case the walrus actually finishes off the seal by, walrus bends its head over, puts its lips against the seal's head and basically sucks its brains out. So luckily it took me lower down, but also, you know, while that particular walrus reacted by letting me go, I can imagine that some walruses, even though they're as surprised to be hit on the head, their reaction would just be, oh, hold on, I'll just hold on to this a bit tighter. And if I'd held on tighter and taken me down, that would have been it, because I was only snorkeling and it was a total surprise. total surprise.
I wanted to ask you about that, because obviously you do quite a lot of work just snorkeling. I mean, so you've not got scuba tanks or anything of the kind. How long can you stay under?
Well, once I'm up to speed again, maybe 2.5 minutes, something like that, which is, it's okay, but, you know, there's a cameraman I know called Tom Fitz, who can do a genuine 6 minutes underwater. Wow. And I was working with a guy called Guy Stevens on manta rays, and Guy, he can hold his breath for 4.5 or so. And it's remarkable when you're underwater with a guy who can hold it that long, because I would be down on this reef, you know, sort of at the bottom of the reef, looking up when the manta rays come above you, and Guy would come down beside me, and he was getting ID photographs from underneath. And I would be, and I'd look around, and he's still there. I'd take a few photographs, and you look around, he's still there, for God's sake. You know, you're watching, I mean, 4 minutes is a long time to be underwater with someone. So, you know, it is useful, because there are times when you want to be super light and not, you know, spook the animals and things. We're using what are called rebreathers now, which is basically a breathing system for underwater, which doesn't give off any bubbles. And that can help sometimes with whales and seals, because basically when you blow bubbles at a seal or a whale, that's the kind of things that seals do to each other when they're not happy, when they're a wee bit wary or want to show a bit of aggressive territorial. You'll see them, you know, snort some bubbles out of their nose. So a person underwater blowing bubbles is not only noisier for whales and seals, but he or she has given off their own kind of cues for getting the whale to relax.
I think folk are fascinated with what you do because of this aspect of privileged access. Yeah. I mean, you get to see things and things that normal folk don't. What is it like to be, you know, just hanging there in the water confronted by a whale that's bigger than a double-decker bus?
Well, yeah, that's the word for it. It's privileged. And it's privileged from two points of view. It's privileged because, you know, you're doing something that a lot of people either aren't allowed to do or they don't have the money to do. I mean, nobody can afford to go and take a boat out every day for a month on Tonga, you know, but we had the funding and the deal to do that. So it's a great privilege, but it's also, I've been realising, an enormous privilege, an enormous thing that the whale is or the animal is giving you, because any wild animal, unrestricted, like a whale or a polar bear, one of its options is to be unhappy and swim away. So the fact that these animals are coming and choosing to spend time in your presence is a great honour that you're being paid by these animals. And so the very least you can do is give them the respect back again. And hopefully that respect becomes friendship. And that's when you get, you know, really special things happening between you and them. It's not always good for the cameras, you know, because they can be almost too friendly to you. They want to be around, you know. It's rather like looking for natural behaviour out of a dog, but once you start stroking it, all the dog wants is to be stroked some more. But it is one of the privileges of wildlife filming, is the access that we are given to animals, places and people, which are not granted to very many people. The kind of, not the sad side, but the ironic thing is that, you know, we make these wonderful films and it just means more and more people want to go and see these things for themselves. So there's a lot of pressure on the world's wild places in terms of visitors' numbers. Not just Venice and, you know, these other famous human-made places, but the world's wild places. More and more people want to go and see and experience them for themselves.
When David Attenborough started doing his work, maybe 60 years ago, I'm guessing here that it was probably easier to go and find genuinely wild places, untouched places, you know, virgin, complete, perfect.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it must be quite difficult to shoot that. You know, you must have to pick your shots quite carefully sometimes.
Yeah, well, we do. You know, we do frame out the fences and, you know, exclude the human side of things, which some people claim is, you know, making a false view of the world. I don't think it's a false view of the world, but it's a very niche view of very small parts of the world. There are still large areas of wilderness, you know, the Russian tundra, the areas of the Amazon rainforest, bits of the, you know, a lot of the Arctic, a lot of the Antarctic. You know, they look much the same as they did, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, but they are getting smaller and they are being impacted by climate change, or climate breakdown, as I prefer to call it. You know, there's no place on Earth which is sacrosanct. Climate change will reach out and has the ability to change some places beyond all recognition.
This last big series, Blue Planet 2, that the BBC produced, it was interesting to my mind by virtue of the fact that they put up the problem of plastics in the oceans. And all of a sudden, everybody was talking about it, and big things started to happen. You know, and it does make you wonder, if you hadn't been framing that stuff out all those years, if you had been shown the negative side of things earlier, would it have been better?
Well, that's a good point. You know, and if you look back through history, you know, there have been good films made about issues, but I don't know what it was. They do say that the audience has to be ready to listen as much as the storyteller has to be ready to tell. And I do know from the years of filming that I've been doing, and the last sort of 5 to 10 years where I have been more involved with issues-led films for other companies besides the BBC, I know that the interest now from young people and from older people too, there is a fresh surge of interest in the environment. Maybe it's because things have got so bad that they're unmistakable, or maybe the message is finally getting through again. But, you know, we had a really powerful Earth movement, so to speak, through the 60s. And that NASA image of Earthrise, you know, the blue marble in space coming up against the grey moon, that really epitomised that sort of generation. And I would say by the early 70s, we had a really powerful, you know, progressive conservation movement, and then suddenly we lost it. You know, we moved politically, economically, you know, in the developed world, we moved from an awareness of nature to kind of super materialism. And from the late 70s, the Maggie Thatcher, the Reagan era, and then all these economics which just said, oh, don't worry, you know, the market forces will control everything, we really seriously lost our way, and the environment paid the price for it. And we're now going to have to find a new way forward with less consumption and more renewables, a whole different way of doing things if we're going to carry on, you know, as a species that's looking after the planet. But it's going to mean big changes, and we have to do them quicker than, I don't know, I mean, you know, social change can happen quickly, you know, and attitudes can change quickly, and I'm hoping that we're now on the cusp of people genuinely turning somewhere else. But we're going to have to turn our back on a lot of economics. Every time that people stop buying things, the shout goes up, recession, quick, get out there, buy. And that ain't a model for the future.
This is a question that I very nearly asked you last night, but I didn't want your presentation to end on a negative note. But I am curious to see what your thoughts are this. With what you know, with what you've seen, the experiences you had, are you optimistic that we will make those changes? Are we smart enough as a species?
That's a good question. I think if you're optimistic, pessimistic and realistic, there is still time to do a lot. But we have to do a lot, and we have to do it quickly. And my concern is that the speed of change is going to be too slow for the planet's good. I think that we need to have a massive investment from governments around the world to make the swing towards electric cars and renewable energy, all that sort of stuff. We shouldn't be looking to the public to start paying more for that sort of thing. We should be adopting the same kind of attitude with money towards climate change and changing the way we do things as we did towards the banking crisis. You know, we found $2 trillion in a year to sort it all out. The other one is, you know, the Americans, when they decided to put a on the moon, they said, okay, we don't care what it costs, we'll put $50 billion aside for it, but we're going to do it. Now, if we had that kind of attitude, that kind of warlike footing against all the things that are causing climate change, plus a change in perception of people, then I think we could do a lot. And I think with money and the right sort of initiatives and things like that we could do an awful lot towards it. But we've got to do a lot, and we've got to do it fast.
One last question for me, and it's maybe an odd one. I mean, we're not in a wild environment. We're walking along the beachfront here in Aberdeen.
Well, enough for me, I'll tell you.
Well, it's a chilly sort of day. But are you saying, you know, there's all the sort of wind turbines out there, the marine wind turbines, there's all the supply boats waiting out there, the taxi boats. I love this kind of weather. I love storms. But if I bring my wife down here, she looks at that and she thinks, cold, scary, don't like it. When you look at the water, when you look at the sea, what does it mean to you?
Well, I look at the Aberdeen Sea breaking against the shore and you think, you wouldn't get me in there for a, you know, for all the tea in China. But, you know, the sea is a wonderful place, isn't it? You know, the fact that this sea, you could go on this sea and without coming off the sea, you could visit any other place on the planet. It's just great. It got inside my bones early on and I've been lucky to see it in all its moods in all so many places. And I enjoy coming out and walking along the sea because the good thing about water is it's never the same from one minute to the next, one hour to the next. The light is changing on it. The conditions are changing on it. You know, there's something basic and strong and powerful about the sea, but at the same time, it's a great environment to feel confident enough with that you're happy to go sailing on it or diving under it. And so, you know, I will always want to live by the sea.
Wildlife cameraman and conservationist Doug Allen has some very interesting ideas and a fascinating fella. And as I said earlier, I was very obliged to him for giving me that time. That, I'm afraid, is all we've got time for on this podcast. Join us again as soon as you can. From all the team here at Aberdeen, thanks for downloading us.